Okay, so we're at class three. Everyone's still relaxed?
After all the singing.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. So we've covered the section in the text, the last class, on the emptiness of self. So in emptiness teachings, it's traditional to divide emptiness into two kinds of emptiness: the emptiness of me and the emptiness of mine, the world; the emptiness of self and the emptiness of phenomena. And this is the full strength version of the emptiness teachings, is to teach both those things. So the emptiness of self we already covered in the last class, and you know, as I said before, it takes a lot of review over and over again to truly convince yourself that you're not there. To truly convince yourself that the you, the I, that we are so sure has to be in there somewhere, just can't be there. An illusion, just an illusion, just a phantom. So in these verses, beginning in verse 79, we turn to the other half of the emptiness teachings, the emptiness of phenomena. They say mine because, you know, that's how it is, right? When we think about our reality, we think about me and we think about my world, right? There's no other world except for my world, for me, right? It's not like I know anything about your world. I know about my world. So the world, the phenomena, outside world, external world, is sometimes called mind, mama. Aham, I, and mama, mine, in Sanskrit. All right. So just as he, very interesting, just he used the, do you remember the example he used to talk about the emptiness of me? He used several different examples, but he used the example of my body and my mind, right? If I'm trying to find the I, so maybe it's in some part of my body or in all the parts of my body. Maybe it's in my mind or all parts of my mind. So then, when he turns the attention to the emptiness of mind, of phenomena, he starts with the body again. Because I have a body. My body. My body. So the body here is representing everything that's not me, but is mine. Okay? You see? Yeah. It's also one of the five skandhas, for those of you who know the skandhas, the heaps. Is the heap of form. And the primary form that we're interested in is the body. Yeah. You ready?
Yes.
So the first couple of verses here are, is the body findable? Is the body findable in the parts? So what is the body? You know, the body seems like a whole thing, right? We say my body, we say it's one thing. It's a whole, like a car. One of the most ancient images to talk about this aspect of emptiness is the chariot. You know, so a chariot is one thing. It seems like a chariot is one thing, right? Modern version of this is an automobile, car. So when we say car, you know, we think, well, that's one thing. But does the car have parts? So the car has the wheels and the, you know, chassis and the engine and the, you know, the seats and the steering wheel, et cetera, et cetera. So it is the car in any one of its parts? Is the car the same as the steering wheel? Is the car the same as the wheels? So no. But is the car the same? Is the car when all the parts of the car are put together? And you could say, yeah, I mean, that makes sense, right? It makes sense to say car is all the parts of the car put together. But actually, all the parts of the car are not a car. All the parts put together of a car are not a car until what?
It's a driver.
Yeah, good. That's a good answer. until you say car. That's a car. It's a label. Remember the example of the battalion or the, what was it, the company or whatever it was? Yeah. It's just a name. It's a name that we overlay a collection of parts. And then we think, well, that's one thing. But the only oneness of the thing is in the label. You see? The only unity, the only wholeness, W-H-O-L-E-N-E-S-S. The only wholeness of the car is in the label that we slap on it. That's the only oneness of the car. So it's the same with the body. So here he goes. The body is not the feet, not the calves, the thighs, or the hips. So it's just in analyzing the parts of the body, just like you could analyze the parts of a car. It is not the belly, the back, chest, or arms. It is not the hands, the ribs, or the armpits. And it is not the shoulders. The body is not the neck, nor the head. So where is the body? Where is it? If it's not in any of its parts, where is it? If the body exists partially in all its parts, so you could say, well, maybe the body partially exists in the thighs and partially exists in the hips, etc. If the body exists partially in all of the parts, and the parts exist in the parts, where is that which stands by itself? So now he's saying, the whole, W-H-O-L-E, is constructed of parts, made up of parts. And the parts of the whole are made up of other parts. And down you go. So this is a very standard argument for the emptiness of things. Which comes first? The whole or the parts of the whole? Which comes first, the body or the parts of the body? Well, the parts of the body, right? You can't have a body that comes first before the parts of the body, right? So then you say, well, there's the parts of the body, the elbow and the hands and all of that come before there's a body. But are there parts of a body before there's a body of which they are parts of? You see what I mean? So there can't be a body before the parts of the body, and there can't be parts of a body before there's a body for them to be parts of. Each exists dependently on the other. The body exists dependently on the parts of the body, but the parts of the body also depend on the body of which they are parts. Neither can exist without the other, and neither can come first. And neither can come first. So if the body was fully present in the entirety and so forth, then there would be as many... So this is the next one. If the body was fully present in its entirety, in the hands and so forth, in each one of its parts, if each one of the parts of the body, if the body was in each one of the parts that made up of the body, then there would be how many bodies? As many bodies as there are parts of the bodies. If the body was fully present in its entirety, fully present in each part, in the hands and so forth, then there would be as many bodies as there are hands in the rest. Okay, so the body can't be found in any one of its parts, because if it were, or all of the parts, because then there would be many, many bodies. Yeah? The body is not inside or outside. The body is not found within the parts, and the body is not found apart from the parts. Like, well, what would that mean, that there could be a body that didn't have the parts of the body? So it can't be apart from the parts of the body, but it can't be found in the parts of the body either. So how could the body is not inside nor outside. How could the body be in the hands and the rest? But it also cannot be separate from the hands and the rest, etc. Right? How can it be at all? The body is an illusion. The idea of a whole, W-H-O-L-E, called the body, is an illusion. Or you could say it's just a name. So sometimes they say that things exist only nominally. Nominally means just by name only. This is not a cup from its own side. Okay? It only becomes a cup when you conceptualize it and name it cup. That's what brings it into existence as a cup, purely nominally. Then he's the next verse. There is no body. Typical Shantideva. Just forget about it. There is no body. But because of delusion, there is the idea of a body somewhere among the hands and the rest due to a particular arrangement of the parts. Because of delusion, because we think that our concepts of things are the things. And we are deluded about that. Because of the particular, you know, collection of parts and the arrangement of them. It is like thinking a pillar is a person. This is a typical ancient Indian example. I think the example that many of us would use is, it's like seeing a mirage in the desert. Like an oasis in the desert. It's just a mirage. And then we mistake the whatever it is that causes mirages, the fluctuation of light or, you know, whatever it is, reflections of light. We mistake it for an oasis. Not the yoga studio in Singapore. The oasis in the desert. So he's saying it's just like a mirage. It's like a mirage, like a dream. The body. And don't forget, he's using the body as a stand-in for all objects, for all phenomena. As long as the assembly of conditions last, the body appears as a person. Similarly, as long as that assembly of hands and the rest last, the body can be seen in them. Right? Projected onto them, you could say. The idea, concept of body can be projected on the parts of the body as long as the parts of the body are there in a particular kind of configuration. Now he goes into so that's the emptiness of holes, W-H-O-L-E. There are no holes. There are no whole things, okay? If there were a whole thing, if this was, this is a meditation that Vaishali's been doing for the last couple of months, which is a very good meditation to do. If this was a whole thing, it'd be one thing, right? Whole means one. W-H-O-L-E means one. One thing, right? Is this one thing or many things? How can it be both? Is one or many? One or many? There's only it can't. These are mutually exclusive. Mutually exclusive. Can't be both. It has to be if it were out there. If it existed out there, it could has to be singular or plural. Plural. So you say plural.
Oh,
because it's got all kinds of parts to it, so maybe it's plural. It's got a handle, it's got this part, got the top part, the bottom part, it's got the inside part, so maybe I'm holding many things. Am I holding many things?
No.
I'm only holding one thing, so it's only one thing. But wait, if it were one thing, how could it have so many parts to it? So, it's many things. No, I'm only holding one cup, so it's one thing. No, but it has so many parts to it. Right? Back and forth. If it were out there, independently of the perception of it, it would have to be one thing or many things. But because we can see it either as one thing or many things, proves that it exists because we are perceiving it. It exists in the way that it does because we perceive it the way it does, and we can perceive it in two different ways. Two logically contradictory ways. We can perceive it from one angle as one thing, from another angle as many things. Okay? So that you could say is another way of talking about the emptiness of holes, W-H-O-L-E. See, if they were really holes, they would be only one thing. Right? And you couldn't see parts in them. If they were really holes. So they become holes. Everyone remember the W in front of this, right? I'm not talking about black holes or, you know, holes in the ground or something like that. If they were really holes, they would not have parts to them. You see? So the wholeness of holes, with W in front of both of them, the wholeness of holes has got to be a projection. Has got to be an imposition on top of the parts of the whole. Okay? Right? On the basis of the parts of the cup, we assemble a cup and we say a cup. But if that's all happening in the mind. That's all projected onto a collection of parts. Okay? So the next part of the argument is, well, what about the parts? Let's talk about the handle of the teacup. What about that? So the handle is a part of the whole of the cup, right? And on the basis of the parts of the cup, we say cup. We project a whole on top of it. Well, what about the parts? Don't they have some kind of wholeness to them? How many handles are here? There's one handle. So maybe it's a whole. You see, down to another level of analysis. So maybe the parts have wholenesses to them. So maybe there's like one handle and one like round part outside and the inside, you know, top side and the bottom side. Maybe the parts of wholes have some kind of wholeness to them. So here we go down. Ready? So there is a foot because of all the toes. So the part, one part of the body is the foot. But does the foot have parts? He says, yeah, there's the toes. But which one is the foot? What, is the big toe the foot? The second toe the foot? Is the little pinky? No, what do you call them? The little toe. Baby toe. Is it the foot? Which one's the foot? And a toe is made possible by the collection of joints. So toes now, where are we at? Foot is a part of the body. Toe is a part of the part, and now the joints of the toe are parts of the part of the body. Okay, right? So does a toe have parts? Yeah, well, yeah, toe has got the joints. So the toe is made possible by the collection of joints. And a joint, the joints of a, what do you call these? I guess that's what they're called, right? The joints of a foot or of a toe or a finger. And the joints is made, and a joint is made possible by the subdivision into its own parts. Parts of the joint. And then there's parts of the joint, and down you go. Oh, he's going to go down for you. The parts exist because of the subdivision into atoms. Anu in Sanskrit, is like the building blocks of reality. A very, very similar idea to the one that modern science used to hold, that things were composed of atoms, indivisible, you know, building blocks of reality. So the parts of the joints, you know, down you go, the parts of 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 the parts are the atoms that make up you know, things. And an atom also depends on its subdivisions into the directions. So here he's saying, even at the smallest level imaginable of analysis, there has to be parts to the part two, to that smallest part two. Minimally, there has to be a right side, a left side, a top side, and a bottom side for it to be a part. You see, for it to be an atom, a basic building block, smallest basic building block that you can imagine, it must have sides to it, must have parts to it too. Right? So a partless part actually is unimaginable. A partless part, you can't even imagine it. What would it, a part that didn't have parts, right side, left side, top side, bottom side, be? It would be everything, indistinguishable from anything. Because there would be no right side. There would be no left side. There would be no top side. There would be no bottom side. See? So then he's going even further. This is subatomic. The atom also depends on its subdivisions into directions. The subdivision of directions, right side, left side, top side, bottom side, depends on empty space. Right? Right side means right side in space, left side in space, top side in space, bottom side in space. So it depends on empty space because of its absence of parts. So now we get into some something that seems like it doesn't have parts, which is what? Empty space. But then he says, therefore there is no atom. Okay? And I think modern physics has come to the same conclusion, that when you get down far enough, it's just empty space. Right? I don't know. Anyway, Shanti David does. Certainly he's saying, and I think modern physics does agree on that, there's no atom that isn't further divisible.
Yeah.
What discerning person would be attracted by form? So now he comes back to the theme. Form, you know, and body kind of usually sort of function interchangeably in these kind of discussions. So what discerning person would be attracted by form, which is just like a dream? Like your body is just like a dream. Form is just like a dream. So why be attracted to bodies, to your body or to other bodies? When there is no body at all, who is a woman and who is a man? All of a sudden, gender disappears. Okay? That's the emptiness. That's the emptiness of phenomena. Using the body as the most example. So next part, the emptiness of feelings. Feelings. Who's that? Barry Manilow or something? That song. I have a strong feeling. You should respect my feelings. Have you ever heard that or said that? You should respect my feelings. And Shanti Davis says, I don't respect your feelings at all because they're not real. If suffering truly exists, you know, suffering comes in the form of feeling, right? I feel bad, I feel sad, I feel unhappy, I feel anxious, I feel whatever. If suffering truly exists, why doesn't it bother those who are joyful? So if suffering were the, you know, kind of hardwired in the world, then there would be no possibility for anybody being anything other than unhappy all the time. Why doesn't it bother people who are joyful? So, and, you know, we all have times of joy, don't we? Yeah, hopefully. I mean, hopefully you've had at least one or two times in your life where, you know, everything just was awesome and great for like 5 minutes. Right? So you weren't suffering then. Everything was fine. If suffering truly exists, why doesn't it bother those who are joyful? If pleasant things are inherently joyful, then why don't they please those who are grief-stricken and such? So then he tries it the other way around. You know, if you're like really bummed out, nothing makes you happy. See, nothing, right? So the very things that used to make you happy have no appeal to you anymore. So these feelings, he's talking about the fact that these feelings aren't, they are only labels in a way. They're only labels. It is, if it is not noticed, because it is overpowered by something stronger. So, you know, if you don't, for example, if you're really, really sad, really depressed, somebody can serve you the best food in the world, and the ones that you like the most, and you won't like it. You won't even taste it. So it's not noticed, this pleasant sensation isn't noticed because it's overpowered by something stronger. Maybe that's the argument. See, whether grief or, you know, or sadness overpowers any possibility for pleasant feelings, right? How can it be a feeling when it's not something felt? If it is not noticed because it's overpowered by something stronger, how can it be a feeling when it's something not felt? In other words, you can't feel two things at the same time. You can't feel both unhappy and sad, is it? Right? So then the opponent goes, well, surely when the gross form of suffering is removed, there's a subtle form of it. You know, so even when you know, life is enjoyable, maybe there's sort of a subtle form of unhappiness that's kind of there still, even while these, you know, pleasant things are happening. So maybe it is possible to feel two things at once. That's the argument, right? If it is simply another form of pleasure, then that subtle feeling is a version of it. So if a subtle feeling is nevertheless a feeling, he's saying. Okay? It doesn't matter if it's subtle or gross in a sense, it's still a feeling. If suffering doesn't arise when the conditions for its opposite have arisen, then surely what arises as what we call a feeling is brought about by the imagination. If suffering doesn't arise when the conditions for its opposite have arisen, in other words, if the conditions for pleasure, for happiness have arisen, and suffering's not felt, doesn't arise, then surely what arises as what we call a feeling is brought about by a label. Okay? Just a feeling one thing and labeling it happiness is the same as feeling something else and labeling it sad. It's the feeling itself isn't happy or sad. It's the label that we put on the feeling. You know, and another sort of way of thinking about this is the same feeling can be regarded by one person as something pleasurable and by another person as something unpleasurable. The same physical feeling, right? I always think of sadomasochists, who get great pleasure, masochists, let's say, who get great pleasure out of pain. The very thing that other people would find unpleasant because it's painful, a masochist would find pleasurable. I do find pleasurable, apparently, right? And so this analysis is put forward as an antidote to it. Meditations that arise from the arena of contemplation are nourishment for practitioners. He's kind of like pauses here and says, you know, this is so awesome. You should meditate on this. It's like food. It's like mind food, spirit food. So now he takes another sort of angle on the question of feelings. Instead of talking about mental feelings, which is kind of sadness and happiness, here he's talking about touch, the feelings of that we have when we touch something. Touching something is impossible. Okay? Doesn't seem like it feels like I'm touching this cup right now. It feels like that, right? But he's going to show you why that's just impossible. Sparsha, they call it. Sparsha in Sanskrit. Contact or touch is impossible. Why? If there is a space between the sense powers and their objects, okay? If there's a space between them, between the power of feeling, the sense power of touching, and the object that it touches, okay? If there's a space between them, then where is the connection between the two? Okay? So, I think ordinarily we think there can't be a space between them. I'm touching, I'm actually contacting the thing. So he's saying, well, yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, if there's a space between the feeling of touch and the thing that you're touching, then, you know, how can you be touching it? You get it? So then he talks the other way. And if there's no space between them, so here's the cash up. If there's no space between them, then they would be one and the same thing. Okay? My fingers and the cup would be the same thing because they're not. There's no space between them. When there's no space between them, they merge into one thing. Isn't it? For there to be separate things like finger, which touches, and an object that you touch, for there to be separate things, there would have to be a space between them. And therefore, they wouldn't really be touching. And if they are really contacting each other and touching, then they're not separate things. I have become, my hand has become a cup. My finger has, and my finger and my cup and the cup are the same thing. Isn't that right? If there's no space between things, then they become one thing. Right? Yeah? No? No, well, think about it. Think about it. For there to be two things, a feeler and something felt, for there to be two things, there has to be some space between them. Right? Has to be a distance between them. And if there is no distance between them, how can you say they're two things? Then there's one thing. Okay, you got Angie's got to work on this. This is Angie's homework. One atom does not penetrate another. So now it kind of like goes back to atoms. One atom does not penetrate another, for that which is without space in between is one and the same thing. So it's not just me saying this, Angie, it's Shantideva. That which is without space in between is one and the same thing. When there is no penetration, when there's no mixing, penetration, there's no mixing. And without mixing, there's no joining together. This is all in support of the argument that physical feeling is impossible, the way we think it is, right? To say that I feel the handle of the cup is actually impossible. Why? There either has to be space between me and the cup for there to be two things called me and cup, or there isn't space between me and the cup, in which case I am cup, because there's no space there anymore. So I can't be feeling it, really. I can't, only in a dreamlike fashion. Can't really be happening. And how could it be called commingling? Contact. How could it be called contact? Samsarga. When there are no parts. If there are no parts observable between things when they are commingled, then demonstrate this. If you're saying that I'm actually touching this, then parts means like separation. If you're saying that I'm actually in contact with the object that I'm feeling, then show how that's possible. Demonstrate it. How can that be? If I'm really contacting it, then there's no difference between me and the cup. If I'm really contacting it. And if I'm not really contacting it, how the hell can I feel it? See, if there's a space between me and the cup, what am I feeling? And if there's not a space between me and the cup, then there's no me in the cup. There's me cup. It is not correct to speak of a commingling of a material. So now it goes to a different kind of angle. Now this is also very interesting. So when I say I'm feeling a cup, is a cup an animate thing or an inanimate thing? It's inanimate, right? It's an object, it's a material thing. When I'm saying I'm feeling the cup, what am I talking about? Am I talking about a material thing? When I'm saying I am feeling, we're talking about a mental thing, right? Mental phenomenon. I'm feeling. So how can a mental thing touch a physical thing? Those are two different things, right? The mind, the mental things, are different than physical things. Everyone agree on that? You know, thoughts are not physical. You could say brains are, you know, have some physicality to them and neurons firing and all like that. But thoughts, feelings, these are ineffable. These are not physical things. It is not correct to speak of a commingling of a material thing with consciousness that has no material form. So consciousness of feeling. It's one of the six consciousnesses. So the consciousness, how can the consciousness contact a material thing? How can a material thing contact a consciousness? It's not correct, he says. Nor with an aggregate, nor with a collection of things, because it is not an existing thing, as we have shown previously. Therefore, since there is nothing in contact, how can a feeling arise? Physical feeling he's talking about. So what are you feeling exactly? Well, I'm feeling the cup, goddammit. So, how can you feel the cup? Are you touching the cup? Yes. Well, then you are the cup. Well, no. I'm feeling the cup. Well, then you're not contacting the cup exactly. Then there must be a separation between you. Well, yeah. Well, then how can you feel the cup? You can only feel the cup in a dreamlike fashion. It can't really be happening. Contact is actually pretty easy to prove is impossible. Contact. So therefore there's nothing in contact. So how can a feeling arise? I mean, let's take a more dramatic example. Like when you touch a hot stove, you get a feeling, right? Feeling, burning feeling, right? So what happened when you touched the stove? Was there a space between you and the hot stove or not? So, and if there's a space between you, well, how did you get burned exactly? And if you became if you touched the hot stove, then you and the stove became the same entity, if you really touched it. So the feeling of being burned is an illusion. I mean, it kind of has to be. Which doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Okay, nobody goes home now and says, "Oh, I can just touch it." I went to Lama Ruth's retreat. He said, "I can, it's just an illusion." Well, that you see, that's the proof that there's reality to illusion. Is that it hurts, we suffer, but that doesn't mean that we suffer for the reasons that we think we suffer. We're not suffering because of the hot stove. The feeling of being burnt is not coming from some kind of physical contact. Impossible. Therefore, since there's nothing in contact, how can a feeling arise? What's the point of getting all worked up over this? Ayasa means like exerting yourself. What's the point of making so much effort and exerting yourself? By what could what be injured? By what could what be injured? You know, this is kind of all, remember he started out saying like, don't hesitate to meditate on emptiness, because emptiness will bring about the end of fear and unhappiness. So it only seems like there's an I that gets injured. And it only seems like there are feelings that arise, either mental or physical. They aren't real. They only have dreamlike existence. And the more you understand the dreamlike existence, the more you realize it, not just understand it intellectually, but realize it, make it real in your life, the less affected you're going to be. Which doesn't mean, of course, that, you know, when you put your finger on the stove, then suddenly you won't feel it anymore, something like that. But you'll understand what a feeling is. You'll understand that a feeling only has the kind of existence that feelings have in dreams, which, you know, which are real, right? When you're scared, like, you know, in dreams, we often have dreams of people chasing you. I don't know if you have that, you know, and you feel afraid. You try to run away and you feel afraid. So the feeling is, you know, has a function. They function for sure. But when you're lucidly dreaming and someone's chasing you, then maybe you don't have the same kind of attachment or the same kind of belief in the feeling that might still arise in the dream. You say, well, I'm just having a dream. A boogeyman is, you know, chasing me, and gosh, that's kind of scary. But you wouldn't be all like, you know, completely at sea about it. You wouldn't all, you know, be buying into the dream. So the self that sees and touches is only like a dream or an illusion. Oh, I skipped one, didn't I?
Yeah.
Since one who feels does not exist, so there's not a feeler, okay? And a feeling cannot be located anywhere, then why do you not destroy craving when it arises if you have seen that this is the case? So then it comes back to craving. Cravings come from feelings, right? We crave, we want, because we have a feeling of desire, feeling. So he says, well, if there's no real feeling, then there's nothing really to crave. And if there's no craver, then who's craving? If there's no feeler, then who's feeling? You know, emptiness of self, emptiness of phenomena. The self that sees and touches is only like a dream or an illusion. Svapna. Svapna means a dream or sleep. And maya, only like an illusion. Since feeling arises simultaneously with the mind, it is not perceived by the mind. So feeling, a physical feeling, and the consciousness of feeling are interdependent. They arise, here he's saying sahaja, simultaneously. So you actually can't feel anything unless you're conscious of feeling something. Right? Yeah. A sensation can only be felt when it... What's the other thing? Sensation and... I forgot now. Anyway, the sensation, the physical sensation, it is ununderstandable, unintelligible to you unless there's a consciousness about the physical sensation. See? Awareness. An awareness. I am touching the cup. You know, fingers don't have awareness. The little things are, the sense things here. What do you call these things? Those, nerve endings. Nerve endings don't have consciousness. So consciousness is necessary for there to be a feeling. Right? The consciousness of feeling has to be there for there to be a feeling, a physical feeling. And there can't be a consciousness of a feeling unless there's a physical feeling. And there can't be a physical feeling unless there's consciousness of a physical feeling. Neither can exist without the other. Because it happens at the same time, it's not experienced. What happened earlier is remembered later. It does not experience itself and is not experienced by anything other. So it's not really felt. The physical feeling is not really felt at the time that the physical feeling occurs. It occurs like a microsecond later when the consciousness says you are feeling something. Not being felt at the time. There is no one who feels and there is no real feeling at all. In this jumble of things that have no essences, near atmika, what is injured by another? No feeler, no thing felt, and no feeling independently. Okay? There's no feeler who exists without something felt. But there's no object that is felt until and unless it's felt by a feeler. Right? Neither can exist without the other. The emptiness of the mind. Back to the mind again. If the mind is not, where is the mind? The mind is not located within the sense powers, nor is it in things that have form. So it's not in the power of seeing, the power of hearing, etc. And it's not in the objects of the senses, visible objects, audible objects, and so forth. Nor is it somewhere in between. So it's not, the mind is not in my visual consciousness, and it, because the visual consciousness doesn't function without an object, a visible object, right? So the mind isn't in the visible in the consciousness of being able to see, the consciousness of seeing. It's not in the object of seeing, it's not in the, you know, the visible object, and it's nowhere in between somewhere, like floating around, right? This is just delving into the ins and outs of the fact that things can only exist interdependently. Okay? Nothing exists independently. Neither can exist without it, and neither can exist first. So you keep saying that like a mantra, but what does that imply, you see? What kind of a world does that imply? Where a visible object can't exist without a seer can't exist without a visible object, neither can exist without the other, and neither can exist first. So you can't say, so Nagarjuna goes into this, he says, things cannot exist sequentially. So first there's the visible object, and then there's a seer who sees the visible object. There can't be first a seer who then sees a visible object. There can't be first a visible object and then a seer who sees the visible object. So they can't exist sequentially. Nor can they exist simultaneously. Why? It sounds like it, you know, from the formula that we've been using, it sounds like we're talking about a simultaneous event, where visible object and seer simultaneously, you know, arise. What's wrong with that picture? Those are two independent things that happen at the same time. A visible object arises at the same time as a seer. Independent, two things independently arising. And that's impossible too. Because there is no visible object until and unless there's a seer, and there's no seer until and unless there's a visible object. There can't be simultaneous arising of two independent things because neither one exists independently. The visible object depends on the seer, and the seer depends on the object. Neither can exist without the other. Neither can come first. Which verse are we at? Oh yeah, second one. That which is neither the body nor anywhere else, which is neither mixed up with something else nor separate from it, that is nothing at all. And so it is that living beings are by nature completely liberated. Beautiful sort of like interlude here. And by the way, Shantideva says, samsara is just a big mistake. All of it is just illusion. It's all just illusion. And we attach to the illusion as if it were real. But if we saw reality as it is, we would realize that by nature, it's always been liberated. We've just mucked it up. We've mucked up nature. We've put the clouds in front of the clear blue sky. All we need to do is eliminate error. By nature, beings are completely liberated. So now he goes into another aspect of mind. This should become familiar to you now, okay? This argument. This argument is just going through the same argument over and over again. If the capacity to know, the ability to know things, okay? That's in the mind, right? If the capacity to know exists before that which is known, okay? The capacity to know and the thing that is known are two different things, right? Which comes first? If the capacity to know exists before that which is known, on what basis does it arise? On what basis does the capacity to know arise if not for the thing that is known? So you can't say it exists before the thing that is known. The thing that is known makes possible the capacity to know. Okay? Everyone all right? It's late. It's getting late, isn't it? Everyone's drifting off here. If the capacity to know exists at the same time as that which is known, so now he's talking about simultaneous arising, on what basis does it arise? If the capacity to know and the thing that is known arise at the same time, then on what basis does the capacity to know arise? There's nothing to depend on because they happen at the same time. Things can't exist sequentially. Things can't exist simultaneously. And if the capacity to know occurs after that which is known, then what would be the capacity? What would the capacity to know? Okay? So things, knowable things, exist dependently on the capacity to know them. They become knowable things when they are known. How's that? And the knower of known things becomes a knower of known things when the known thing is there to know. Neither can exist without the other, and neither can come first. Knowable things and the capacity to know knowable things exist interdependently. Interdependent. All right. So now interdependence. I'm going to rush through this, shall I? I keep turning pages. I know, right? If there's no deceptive reality, then how can there be two realities? So here's the opponent coming up and says, look, you know, it sounds to me like you're saying that things don't exist here. Things don't exist at all, I guess. So if there's no deceptive reality, if there's no truly existing deceptive reality, then how can you say that there are two realities? Sounds like there's only one reality. It's only ultimate reality. This other thing that you're talking about is deceptive reality. You know, kind of, you spend a lot of verses here telling me how nothing really exists much, right? And if it exists because of some other deceptive reality, then how could living beings ever be liberated? If the, you know, if the deceptive nature of the mind is, you know, is truly existing, then how could there ever be anything, you know, how could you ever be free from that? That is a projection of another mind. It does not exist because of one's own deceptive reality. So the deceptiveness of deceptive reality is in the mind only of unenlightened beings. That's kind of what he's saying. And after it is ascertained, it exists. When something, you know, when something appears, when a deceptive reality appears, it when it's understood deceptively, it appears deceptively. And if not ascertained, it doesn't exist. If it doesn't appear deceptively, then it isn't deceptive. Even in deceptive reality, there's a little confusing. The two, conceptualization and what is conceptualized, are mutually independent. Conceptualization, I conceptualize something, and the something I conceptualize, the conceptualizer, and that which is conceptualized exist interdependently in the same kind of way that we've talked about. They're mutually interdependent. All analysis is expressed by taking recourse in common sense. Nagarjuna says this too. All of this stuff is just commonsensical, ultimately. We're not really like kind of contradicting common sense. It's just logical. There can't really be touch. It's just logical. It's just common sense that there, you know, there can't be real touching, because if there was real touching, either there has to be a space between the thing, and the feeler, and the thing felt, or not. And there, either one of them is not commonsensical when it comes to touch. But if one analyzes with an analysis which has already been analyzed, and then there's an analysis of that analysis, there is infinite regress. Simple. What this means, simple. When you think about your mind, when you think about your mind, who's thinking about your mind? Well, it's my mind thinking about my mind. Who's thinking about the mind that thinking is thinking about your mind? Well, it's my mind thinking about my mind, which is thinking about my mind, which is thinking about my mind. And back you go. Infinite regress means there's no end to that. Okay? Right? Let's do it with a different, like, kind of word. If you say, I am a projector, I am a projector of cup onto objects, I'm a projector. When you think about the projector, a projector is projecting a projector. Right? And then when you think about the projector that's projecting the projector, you're thinking about a projector who's projecting a projector who's projecting a projector. And back you go. That's what he's saying. And then, so that was the criticism, actually. That's the opponent. And then Shanti Deva says, that's right. That's right. When one analyzes what has been analyzed, there is no basis of the analysis. There's no end point to the regress. There's no end point. And because there's no basis, there's no arising, and that's what's called nirvana. So to really understand that infinite regress, he says, is what nirvana would be. To really understand that it's all just conceptual elaboration. That's another way of, you know, a phrase that's sometimes used in these kinds of texts. Those who maintain that both that both truly exist, what the conceptualization and what is conceptualized, are standing on shaky ground. If an object exists due to the power of its being knowable, how do we arrive at the true existence of the capacity to know? The capacity to know would depend on the knowable thing. So it doesn't have any true existence. True existence means something that exists independently. Independently. So the capacity to know depends on the knowable thing that the capacity to know knows. Right? And the knowable thing depends on it being known by the capacity to know. Both depend on each other, and neither can come first. And if the capacity to know exists due to the knowable thing, how do we arrive at the true existence of the knowable thing? This is just all like repeating what we've been saying. Same formula. And if each exists due to the power of the other, then there's no true existence for either of the two. That means anything that exists dependently on something else has no true existence. True existence means independent existence. Doesn't need anything else to exist. So anything that you can prove depends on something else for its existence has no true existence. Without a father, there is no son. Where would the son come from? So, you know, this is the argument. Well, you know, there has to be a father for there to be a son, right? There has to be something that comes from something else. And then Shanti Deva says, yeah, but without a son, there's no father either. Fathers exist as fathers dependent on children, right? And children exist as children dependent on parents. Neither can come first. There can't be a father until and unless there's children, right? The father becomes a father when there's children, right? So you're saying that, and that's applicable everywhere. That kind of principle is applicable everywhere. Sons and daughters depend on fathers and mothers, but fathers and mothers to be fathers and mothers depend on sons and daughters. Neither can exist without the other, and neither can come first. You're not first a father and then have a son or a daughter, right? Same principle. A sprout arises from a seed, says the opponent. And because of the seed, the sprout manifests. Something comes first. The seeds come first and the sprout comes. The capacity to know arises because of that which is knowable. So why can't we conclude that it truly exists? And then Shantideva answers, a seed exists due to the capacity to know that is different from that which knows the sprout. So the awareness of a seed is different from the awareness of the sprout. Because they occur at different times, right? Yeah. And when knowing the capacity to know means it becomes a knowable thing, how can that capacity to know truly exist? So basically what he's saying here is that it isn't a cause. The seed isn't a cause for the sprout until and unless there's a sprout that it's a cause for. So now he's morphing into causality. And since we all went through this, you know, in Singapore a couple months ago, or many of us did, right, on causality, the emptiness of causality, we can all recall that and go through the rest quickly and go to bed. Which comes first, the cause or the effect? Well, the effect can't come first, right? Effect can't come before the cause, so the cause has to come before the effect, right? Is the cause of the effect, is the seed the cause for the sprout until and unless there's a sprout? No. Okay, it's not a cause, it's just a seed. So it's not the cause for the sprout until the sprout comes. So you could say, well, the effect has to be there for the cause. But the effect and the cause can't occur at the same time either, right? Simultaneous. If the seed and the sprout occurred at the same time, you couldn't say one was the cause and one was the effect. So you have to have, it has to be either sequential or simultaneous. Right? If it were happening out there, it would have to be one comes first, then the next comes, that's sequential, or they both happen at the same time. A seed can't, a cause can't come before the result, because the cause is a cause only when it's for a result, when the result has occurred. Yep. The result can't come before the cause, so they can't happen sequentially, nor can they happen simultaneously, because then you couldn't tell the difference between a cause and effect, because they're happening at the same time. Okay? So if they can't occur sequentially, and they can't occur simultaneously, they can't really be occurring at all. So this is the emptiness of causality. Ready? Worldly people observe with direct perception all kinds of causes. You know, people, common sense, people see all kinds of causes in things. The various parts of a lotus arise due to various causes. So, you know, among other things he's saying, and things can't exist without causes either. Things don't just arise out of nothing. Okay? So what produces this variety of causes? The variety of causes previous to them. He's going to work his way up here to an argument about how nothing can have a first cause. But on the way to that, he's also saying that there is no one cause for anything. Causality is complicated. What produces the, you know, so there's a variety of causes that come into making a lotus stalk, he's saying here. A variety of causes come into play. And what causes the variety of causes that bring about a lotus stalk? Well, another variety of causes. A whole bunch of other causes. A whole bunch of causes come together to make a lotus stalk. Well, what brings those causes together? Well, a whole bunch of other causes. And back you go. You know, causality. If you work your way through, like, how causality must work, then your mind also gets blown. No, and you stop thinking that you can understand things, really. If you work your way through the, you know, kind of complexities of causality. So now he goes into, well, what about the first cause thing? Maybe there's a God who is the first cause. God is the cause of this whole world. This is the opponent. So then Shantideva says, well, tell me who God is then. If you're saying God's just the physical elements, then, you know, we all agree. Physical elements, you know, are building blocks of reality. Physical elements, in, you know, in the ancient world meant, you know, fire, water, air, space, and what? Earth. But the elements, he says, earth and the rest, are multiple, impermanent, powerless, and are not divine. So if you're saying God is the elements, then what kind of God's that? They can be stepped on and are impure. So earth can be like stomped upon. What kind of God is that? No God. Empty space is not the Lord either. What about empty space? For it is powerless. If you say like God is space, God is empty space, then it can't do anything. Empty space doesn't do anything. Empty space is causeless. It has no cause. And because it's causeless, it can't do anything. It can't function. It just, you know, kind of holds things. It doesn't do anything with them. And he's not the self, as we have proven above. How can the inconceivable one's inconceivable ability to act ever be described? So, you know, kind of playing with words here. If it's inconceivable, then forget about it. You can't describe it. What would he wish to create? If it were a self, then surely the elements and the Lord would all have a permanent self nature. If a self-existent God created a self, then the self would also be self-existent, permanent self-nature. The capacity to know is due to a knowable thing and is without beginning. So, you know, he's also saying here, by the way, causality in general can have no beginning. There can't be a first cause. Every cause is a result of a previous cause. Right? Every cause is just, every result repositions as a cause for another result. And there's no possible beginning to that chain. Happiness and suffering come from karma. Tell me, what is created by this God? If there's no beginning to causes, how can there be a beginning to results? If he does not depend on something else, why is he not perpetually creating? So something that doesn't depend on something else is what it is, okay, in and of itself. So if you say a creator is independently a creator by nature, so with a self-nature of creating, then it would always be created, constantly be created, because that's all it was. If there was a surfer who was essentially a surfer, that would be the only thing that person could do, have to surf all the time, could never stop surfing. Why? I'm a surfer. If I was a creator, I couldn't do anything else but create. You see what I mean? Yeah. If you were a walker, truly a walker, you would just have to walk all the time. Never stop walking. Why? I'm a walker. I have to walk. If he doesn't depend on something else, why is he not perpetually creating? If there's nothing not made by him, on what would he depend? So it's either independent or depending. So if it's independent, then the creator would be creating all the time, because that's what a creator does, independently creating. If it depends on something else, then on what would that be? If the first cause depended on something else, then you couldn't really say it's the first cause, because it's depending on something else that caused it to create. If he depends on a collection of causes, then again, the Lord cannot be the single cause. The Lord cannot create by himself, you could say, when the collection of causes are present, because then it wouldn't be an independent creator. Collection of causes come about and cause the creator to create the creator, you could say. Yeah. And when they are not present, he can't create. If there's no cause, how can there be a result? If the Lord creates without desiring to do so, so does the first cause, does the creator desire to create or not desire to create? If the Lord creates without desiring to do so, then it follows that he does so dependently on something other than himself. Some other external cause. If it's not internal, the desire is an internal cause. If it's not an internal cause, well, then what's the external cause? And if he desires to create, then he depends on desire. So how can there be an independently existing creator God? Where is the lordship of the Lord? By the way, in some forms of the Hindu tradition, they have an answer for this question of why. Why did God create? And the answer is, for the hell of it. No, lila it's called in Sanskrit. Lila. Play. Just no reason. No reason. And that's a pretty good answer, actually. If you're going to have a creator God, and you know, you got to explain that. Well, what, was the creator God lonely? What kind of creator God is that, you know? Better get a better God. It's a lonely God, you know, in need of creating something, you know, some kind of like desire or need or some sort of sense of, you know, absence or, you know, what. So the very pretty good answer is no, there's no reason. No reason at all. And in a way you could say that comes to the same answer. You know, why is the world? You know, oftentimes I get this question. And by the way, I wanted to say something about the questions. Remind me later, okay? I often get this question of like, well, you know, why do we suffer? What caused it? What's the first cause? And, you know, and the Buddhist tradition consistently says, well, there's no first cause to everything. It's been happening since time with no beginning. And if you say it's happening from time with no beginning, if there's no first cause, then you could also say that it's without purpose. If there's no first cause, a first cause is something that is done purposefully in order to bring about a result, right? Purposeful. But if that cause is just a result of a previous cause, which is itself a result of a previous cause and back without beginning, then you can say, well, there's no purpose, there's no point. It's just play, lila, right? Samsara is just a game. It's just a game with no beginning, no purpose, no rule. And so it comes to the same thing, I think, really, if you think about it. To say that God created the world out of, you know, for the hell of it, and to say nobody created anything, there's no first cause to anything, I think it comes to the same thing when it comes to the meaning of samsara. You know, why are we in samsara? No reason. So, Let's have enough. Uncle, crying uncle. We'll finish off tomorrow. We're almost done with a nice chapter. Covering a lot in a quick amount of time. So you have time to recover after the retreat. When you go back to work, you can recover from the retreat. The exercise for this class is on the part of the text that deals with the emptiness of feelings. Every day this week, stop for a few moments and observe whatever feeling is dominant at the moment. Happiness, sadness, anxiety, fear, or whatever. Just get in touch and observe it. Does it seem to have some kind of persuasive fixity? Does it seem like it's really there? And this is the way I'm going to feel for a long time. You know, when we have, especially negative feelings, we convince ourselves very quickly that this is for real. Not only am I really feeling this, but I'm always going to feel this way. This is why people commit suicide, actually. You know, they get really, really depressed, and they say, well, this is the way I'm going to always feel the rest of my life, and I'd rather not live like this. So we convince ourselves pretty easily that, they have permanence. Keep watching it until you notice it changing into another sort of feeling, okay? If you don't, once again, if you don't buy into it, if you don't invest it, if you don't say, let's empower it, it arises and you feel away for a little while, and then you feel something else come on. It takes over from how you used to feel, and over again like that. So if you don't grasp onto it, you see, if you don't grasp onto it as if it were real, as if it were a real thing that's really there and that's going to really last a long time, if you don't grasp onto it like that, they come and go. Just come and go. We've all noticed, even in the worst times of life, like in great grief and stuff like that, you're not like always just decimated. You know what I mean? Get relief once in a while, and then I remember now, I'm supposed to be really sad. And then you get really sad again, and then, something else happens. Look at that. I'm supposed to be really... They just come up and down, up and down, up and down. Just the flux of life like that. All right. Oh.